When a person says to me that they want to use technology in the classroom, I immediately go right into backward design and we start talking it through. And quite frankly, as a side note, I will say, anybody who says to me, I want to use this certain technology, my first goal is always to try to talk them out of it. And I really believe that if I can easily talk you out of a certain technology, you shouldn't use that technology. If I can't talk you out of it, okay, now we're starting to get toward a good use of technology.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
If you missed part one of this two-part conversation, you can access the first episode on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or the Digital to Learn website. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Welcome to the Digital to Learn podcast. I'm here with my co-host, Tiffany Snyder.
Hi.
How are you, Tiffany?
I'm doing really well.
I'm especially excited today because our guest is Todd Zagrosik from the University of North Carolina and the Lilly Conferences. Welcome, Todd.
Well, thank you, Brad. Appreciate that.
So we want to hear from you. What are the ground rules that you would suggest for making good decisions about the inclusion of technology?
Oh, I would say the shinier, the better.
Okay.
Had to do that, right?
Yeah.
Well, we all know what that means, right? Yeah, there's so much times that people will use something because it's shiny. Mm-hmm. And that concept that's out there of, I'm going to use clickers because all my friends are using clickers, or I'm going to use this new technology. I want to use Kahoot because, you know, the students love to have Kahoot in the classroom.
Yep.
So it's backward design. We just come right back to backward design. Mm-hmm. What do you want to accomplish? How are you going to know you got there? And then how are you going to go about getting there? When a person says to me that they want to use technology in the classroom, I immediately go right into backward design and we start talking it through. And quite frankly, as a side note, I will say, anybody who says to me, I want to use this certain technology, my first goal is always to try to talk them out of it. And I really believe that if I can easily talk you out of a certain technology, you shouldn't use that technology.
Interesting.
If I can't talk you out of it, then I think we got something. So let me do this, and I'll come right back to the end of the question here. Is if you say, I want to use clickers in the classroom, and I say, why? You say, I just want to use clickers. And I say, well, I think it's a bad idea, and you shouldn't use them. You know, the batteries will die. The students will forget them. You know what you could do is just have students raise their hands. Instead of having them click clickers, just say, what do you think of this? Have them raise their hand, because students almost never forget their arms in class. They bring them all the time. And they never run out of batteries. Although it can be tiring to raise your hand, they won't run out of batteries. And then the faculty member might say, yeah, but I want anonymous responses. Okay, have everybody close their eyes and then raise their hand. Okay, well, I want to be able to post the responses. Oh, so you want real-time feedback anonymously from the students that you can then post. Why? Well, I want to have students understand that their perspective is not the only perspective. Okay, now we're starting to get toward a good use of technology. Mm. So we start with the backward design and say, what is it you really, really want to have happen? So my ground rules is that the technology should advance the teaching and learning in the classroom in a way that you can't do it without the technology.
So how...
And if you...
Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
So how might you go ahead about evaluating that?
Mm-hmm.
With or without technology, how would you evaluate... At the end of the day, which was the most effective?
Oh, well, this is easy because it's just the fact of evaluation and assessment. Since everybody's already doing assessment of all of their student learning, is you just compare the two groups. Mm. That's kind of a joke. First thing we need to do is get really consistent with our assessment of student learning. But think about it that way. And I'm glad you brought that point up, is if we're not really assessing student learning through a good backward design model, how do we know that anything works then? Mm-hmm. So let's think about the first day of class. Is if I say, what's your real goal for the first day of class? You say, I just want students to feel like they're part of a community. Okay, cool. How are you going to know at the end of the first day that there's a community? And then folks will stare at me and say, well,
not sure.
Guess if they're talking. Okay, that is good one measure. If they leave the room and they're talking, everybody's chattering and like they really have a lot of energy, that's a good indication that you've started to build a community. Do you know if you started to build a good community? Maybe they're chattering how much they hate your class. In which case, you have built a community, just not the community you wanted. Mm. So how do you know you've built a good community? And then faculty will start thinking about it and they'll say, well, I guess if students like are talking to each other, or, oh, I know, how about if I ask them, to what extent have you met somebody? To what extent do you like being in this class? Now you're getting there. Mm-hmm. So the point is, once you've identified how do you do it, and one way to do it is to ask the students, hey, have I built a good community? Have we started the community building? And this is what I've been trying to do. Is there any way that we could better build community? But if you start to collect that information, then I could introduce technology and I could keep collecting that assessment data at the end of every class or the end of whenever you're collecting it and see if it's making a difference. Mm. So if my class, let's just go with the community. Maybe I want to integrate some kind of a technology in my classroom that's going to help build the camaraderie and the community of the class. We're going to have asynchronous chats outside of class. We're going to use different classroom technologies to really have people work together within the class period. And if I'm collecting my data about how much community there is, and I now have started using these new digital technologies and the community has gone up precipitously, and that's how we do research. Mm.
And the examples you've given, it's been one of your asking questions to a faculty member about a chosen approach or use of technology or whatever that might be. It seems to me that, generally speaking, in higher ed, people are doing private things in their classrooms. I go in my classroom, I close the door. I don't really know what's going on next door, and we never really talk about it. Mm-hmm. So how do we create those places and spaces where faculty can ask one another the kinds of questions that you've posed?
See, this just, to me, this is a whole mindset shift. If I walk down the hall, let's do it this way. If you're at Indiana Wesleyan and we're walking down the hall there, or at UNC Chapel Hill, and I see you in the hallway and I say, hey, Brad, what you working on? People will talk about research, reading. They almost will never say what they're working on with respect to teaching, right?
Right.
If we walk down the hall and you said, hey, Todd, what you working on? Well, I'm only working on this differentiation between active learning and lecturing because that really kind of bothers me to how that's set up as a balance. Or I'm really working on these new technologies that I think will help the classroom. It's rare that I would say, I'm really working on how do I catch the attention of the students within the first 2 minutes of class period in a way that can sustain it throughout the class period. Mm-hmm. So when this implicit kind of feeling of what are you working on doesn't come back to the classroom, it means it doesn't feel like that's the communication, that's the conversation that we're expecting to have. What I'd love to have happen is you come down the hall and I'd say, hey, Brad, what you working on? And you'd say, oh, well, I'm working on this new way of assessing my students and trying to figure out how to help them to learn better. And if those types of things are happening, then I think we've got a really nice way of moving forward.
Absolutely.
But that's going to entail us, and I'll go back to this one too, is that's going to entail us to really be pushing more of a growth mindset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so if we don't have like growth mindedness is the way that we're thinking about this, then I don't see how we can get to a feeling of where we're going to be talking to each other.
Absolutely.
About teaching and learning. So it it comes back to growth mindedness.
Absolutely right.
Well, we have you on this omnipresent platform, Digital to Learn. So what advice would you like to give to every faculty member on planet Earth? Because we know they're all listening.
Wait a minute. It scared me, first of all. And I only heard I was starting to listen to it, and then it's like the chicken eater, mean person, the whole planet Earth thing. So what was this again?
We've actually verified that every faculty member on the planet has listened to this podcast. So
you can tell.
That is so cool.
Yes. Right,
so my advice for what aspect?
I'm gonna have to tell you, you can definitely tell that Brad developed this question.
Yeah, it's a little convoluted, really. Go ahead.
And so is he.
No, if we're assuming that every faculty member on planet Earth is listening in to this podcast right now, and you've got an opportunity to give them some advice, what advice would you share?
I guess that comes back to still the growth mindset kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm still working at this hard. I'm still working at this so diligently, but to really maintain a growth-minded focus for teaching and learning. So people talk about growth-minded versus fixed-minded, but times people talk about it as if a person is growth-minded. We don't, within the same human being, you can have growth and fixed. Mm-hmm. I could be very growth-minded about basketball. The more I practice, the better I get, and I got to go practice, but also very fixed-minded about drawing. Oh, yeah, I'm a bad drawer. I'm a bad drawer who's going to practice basketball. That's fixed and growth right there together. So if we think about for faculty members is to have growth-mindedness with respect to teaching and growth-mindedness with respect to how we help students to learn. Mm-hmm. And so I guess it's that comes back to that growth-mindedness because if you're truly growth-minded, there's all kinds of little things that come along with that. So if a student says to you, you stink as a teacher, you shouldn't be teaching, your immediate response to that as a growth-minded person, and nobody likes to be told they're terrible at stuff, is the immediate thing for a growth-minded person would be, oh, well, gosh, I want to be a better teacher. How might you suggest I be a better teacher? A very fixed-minded person is going to say, how dare you? As a student, you're telling me that it's my fault you're not learning, or maybe you don't understand what I'm teaching. Maybe if you came to class once in a while, you would get what I'm trying to do. Mm. You see the divergence very, very quickly.
Yes.
In terms of blaming students, and I blame my colleagues, and it's bad classrooms, and if I had a better schedule, and if there were better textbooks, and all that stuff comes from a fixed-minded kind of framework. And the growth-minded side would be, you know, if the textbooks aren't great, everybody's working at trying to be better at textbooks. Nobody purposely writes a bad textbook. So maybe I could submit some letters to the publisher, or maybe I could suggest to an author that's in there who has a third edition of a book out. When you do your fourth edition, it'd be really helpful if you include this. Mm-hmm. And so, oh, by the way, is the whole train on this one. Oh my goodness, I hadn't thought about this one in 30 years. About 30 years ago, I taught a class and we used a new edition of a textbook. I called the publisher because oftentimes publishers will say, if you review this book, we'll give you like $200. They really kind of want you to just read their book and they're paying you to do that. But the concept is we'll give you some money to like accept to the fact or honor the fact it's going to take you a couple hours to go through this and we want to give you a couple hundred dollars to do it. And you'd read a book and you'd give them feedback. I called the publisher one time and I said, hey, I want to use this cognitive psychology book and it's in its first edition. If I have my students point out all of the errors and mistakes that they find in this first edition and we summarize those for you and give those to you because I think this is a good book, but it will have mistakes because it's a first edition.
Sure.
If I summarize all these errors and mistakes and send them to you, would you pay for a pizza party for my students? Let's budget $400 for the pizza party. And they said, absolutely.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I love that.
That's great.
Isn't that cool? And it's a growth-minded framework. Because then what I did is I went to my students and I said, hey, folks, here's the deal. We're going to get a pizza party, but only if you can justify the value of that party. So by the end of the year, we have to be able to document every error we can find in this book. And what we'll do is we're just going to keep track of who finds the errors and we're going to post them so that they don't get reported over and over and over again. So if Tiffany finds an error on page 2, we'll set up a web page that'll say, Tiffany found this. The graph says C figure 1.2, but it's really 1.3. and if Brad says, oh, and on page 2, we found that the author said this, but I think he meant this. And I could then write a little annotated note that says, oh, in the next edition, you might want to think about it this way. We got done with the class, and it was like 4 typed out pages. I think it was barely, back then we barely had computers, but we had 4 pages printed out. We sent those off to McGraw-Hill, and they sent me a check for $400.
That's wonderful.
And the second edition of the book was way better than the first edition. But again, if you think about that, if I just said, we're going to type up every mistake we find in the book and send it to the publisher. An immediate response from a lot of people is, whoa, I bet they're going to be irritated by that. That's not growth-minded. Mm. Growth-minded would be, oh my gosh, that would be fabulous. We would love that.
Yeah.
So I that's my advice to faculty because then the teaching evaluations look different. Comments from students look different. Mm-hmm. Scores on exams look different. The world looks different if we keep thinking growth.
Well, in my experience, one of the best places to begin creating a growth mindset is by attending one of the most excellent Lilly conferences.
There you go.
And I'm hoping you're going to support that position. Could you give us a brief commercial on why anyone would want to attend a Lilly conference?
Well, I guess I think about this quite a bit too, is why, you know, there are a lot of teaching conferences. Mm-hmm. Why is the Lilly conference, you know, any different from any other conference? And I guess what I would say is this, is that number one, I learned this from Milt Cox, we try to build community, and I hope we're mm-hmm. successful when you've been there, but really try to build a community where people just feel like they can talk to each other and they're part of a supportive environment. So I use this example, you've probably heard if you've been to the conference before, is I'll say, you know, the very first time I presented, somebody at the end of my presentation, 12 minutes at American Psych Association, said, well, I'm really surprised you didn't cite, and they gave me the citation for a certain publication and or a published article and said, you know, given that you didn't cite that, it brings doubt to your whole premise and conclusion and everything else.
Wow.
And I'd like to point out, a Lilly conference, we would never do that. Mm-hmm. What we'd say at a Lilly conference is, interesting presentation. I noticed that you didn't cite this one piece of work. Have you heard of that? And then they would pause and you might say, no, I've never heard of that. Oh, well, that's fantastic work. Why don't we sit down at lunch? We can talk about it. So it's that kind of community where you start coming together on things. I really like that. I love to have folks there who are real growth-minded people, and they are. And so we get people who are very supportive from all different disciplines, very growth-minded, helping each other. If I could take the 350 people from the average Lilly conference and start a university, it'd be the most amazing place ever. So it's just great collaboration with a bunch of good people. And I always try to keep the registrations right around, depending on, there's some smaller ones. Asheville mm-hmm. really can only hold about 250, but I love the hotel we're in. But I really shoot for the 350 to 450 for a point. Mm-hmm. And I've had several people have said, well, gosh, I'm really surprised this conference isn't much bigger. It's such a high quality. And I can't imagine why it's not 1,000 or 1,500 people. And I said, well, I can, because number one, I picked a hotel that won't hold 1,000 people. And number two, I don't want an event with 1,000 people. I'm not saying it's bad. If people want to do that, that's great. But when I went to big conferences with 2,000 and 3,000 people, big site conferences, even 1,000 people, if we started a conversation the first morning, there's a chance I wouldn't see you again for the whole conference.
That's very true.
But at the Lilly conference, with about 350 people, there's plenty of different folks there, lots of choices for sessions. But if you see somebody and you have a good conversation, you will see them at lunch. You'll see them in the afternoon. You'll see them in the hallway. And if you come to Austin, when we get on the bus and go to 6th Street, they'll probably be on the bus. So mm-hmm. it's just you see the same person over and over again, but not so small that if they're a creeper, you can still get away from them. Not that you have.
And I have found those things to be true at your conferences. Great sense of community, great conversations, and a very, very encouraging setting. So I think you set the tone for that in the ways that you design and deliver those conferences.
Oh, I really appreciate that. Yeah, it's a ton of work, but I love it. And they're just such great experiences for me. I really enjoy it. I will say that I did a Lilly event up in Fairbanks, Alaska in February.
Wow. Interesting choice.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to be in Alaska, and I wanted a place where people are really serious about learning. Uh-huh. And summertime up there, everybody's outside wanting to go and do things. If you're an Alaska faculty member in the summer, you don't want to be inside. You can go in the spring because everything is mud and black flies or flies and bugs and stuff. In the fall, everybody's preparing for winter. So I said I really wanted to be up there, but they said the only time this would really work is February. And it's right when the international ice sculpture is gone. Now, we don't have the conference anymore, but it was there for a reason. We were there for 6 years, I believe it was. Hmm. But there was a person there, Elizabeth, was one of the elders. We actually included the elders in the conference, which was great. And she said one time, I just found this fascinating. She looked around. We were having kind of a talking circle with about 20 people. And she said, look, I want to thank you all for coming. You had to leave your families. You had to leave your responsibilities. You had to leave the comfort of your home to come to this place. But if you hadn't done all of that, then I wouldn't have had the opportunity to speak with you. And I really, really wanted to do that. So thank you. Thank you for the things that you have done that made it possible for me to be able to engage with you. And I'll tell you, I just sat there and kind of shook my head and thought, that is such a wonderful statement. And it's the essence of everything I do when I run a conference. Every time you've come, I thank you for the obligations you've left behind, the family you've left behind, the comfort of your home, because when you come to the conference, along with the other 349 people, you have allowed me to have conversations that I couldn't have had. Mm. So I am appreciative of every person who comes to that event. Mm. So, yeah. So, love it.
Awesome, Todd. We thank you so much for being with us today. Your passion for teaching and learning and for students and for everything that you do is so evident in everything that you say, and we just really appreciate that.
Well, thank you both. I really appreciate it, and it was great having the opportunity to chat with you.
Okay. We'll see you at the next Lilly Conference.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, and also listening to you at the next podcast.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Todd.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are three things we ask you to do. One, come back and join us again. Two, tell your friends about us. And three, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.